what would happen to someone if they actually advertised and said, we're now 10% dearer than the person down the road. However, we have 15% more staff. We have no restriction on incontinence products. And our average cost per meal per day is 50% ahead of what the industry average is. I think they'd get a lot of people coming to their door.
Welcome to the Aged Care Executive Podcast, the show that's dedicated to helping aged and community care professionals stay ahead of the industry.
Welcome to another episode of the Aged Care Executive Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Peachy, Executive Director of W&L Mobile Healthcare Services. Now, you may have seen in the media recently the results from the Stuart Brown survey. The results of this report that around 43% of aged care facilities are running at a negative earnings before tax. These findings seem to be as a result of the freeze on indexation for the 2018 financial year, the amendments to the ACFI from the 1st of January last year, but also escalating care costs. So in this period of limited funding, how are organisations making over line? Well, today we're lucky enough to be joined by Bruce Bailey, Director of Pride Living and also the Aged Care Advisors Network. As part of his work for the Aged Care Financing Authority when he was with RSM Bird Cameron, his work involved analysing the financial data of every aged care facility in Australia. Today, Bruce gives us some insight into what the facilities that are successful have in common, how organisations can get the best ACFI outcomes, and the key metric that provides an insight into whether or not the ACFI versus staffing ratio is correct. He also gives us some actionable items into what an organisation can do to avoid being in the 43%. So I hope you get a lot out of our interview with Bruce Bailey. Bruce, welcome to the Aged Care Executive Podcast.
Thank you, Mike. I look forward to today's interview and for what it can do for those working in the sector and looking for sort of insights and ideas.
Excellent. Now, with your role in Pride Living, I was just wondering if you could please just give a bit of an overview to start off with what it is that Pride Living actually does.
Sure. Well, having been involved in the sector for many years and dealing particularly in the finance-related space from my background, I was increasingly seeing the need for a more integrated and forward-thinking set of solutions for providers. And so with that in mind, we set up Pride Living as, if you like, a multidisciplinary consulting firm. And the areas that we focus on particularly are quality and compliance. As you know, the new standards are coming out in July next year, so we've got particular programs around that. Resourcing, very much in the news at the moment with the ABC and talking of staff ratios. So we do have a service line around operational support, which deals particularly in relation to getting rosters right. So that's neither under-resourced or over-resourced. And also the other area of that is around additional services, because we believe that the government is always going to reduce, restrict, retain funding, and so the successful providers will look for other sources of revenue. And the third piece, which is sort of the bit where I'm in, is around the strategy and finance, and that covers, you know, do we go into this area, do we get out of this area, is that project worthwhile, where should we be going as an organisation? And if you like, there's a threefold question for that, as we call it. Should I go, as in get out of the industry, should I stay where I am, or should I grow? And so they're the problems that we solve for our clients.
Excellent. And I guess having that multidisciplinary approach and looking at an organisation from so many different perspectives, obviously that gives you a fair bit of insight into what works and what doesn't. One of the things that really interested me is some of the work you did regarding, you know, the whole statistic regarding, you know, 60% of the organisations in the industry are going backwards and 40% who are making a profit or at least, you know, not losing money. In terms of what are the levers that separates the who's losing versus who's keeping afloat. What were the main findings from your work?
Well, that work was actually Stuart Brown's survey respondents, and probably worthwhile to correct it for the minute. Stuart Brown said that 40% of their respondents were losing money and 60% were making money. Now, if anyone's ever done any sort of research, they'll understand that the statistics are as good as the sort of data and, if you like, the participants. Now, whether that's reflective of the whole industry or not, we don't know. But the press has picked up and said, well, given the number of people, it is. And so what we found, we did some work for the Aged Care Financing Authority back in 2015, and we analysed the financial data of every aged care provider in Australia. This was when I was at RSN. And we did a qualitative survey of participants, and the question before us was, what drives the differential financial performance? So if you accept that maybe 40% are not making money and 60% are making money, that's helpful information. But as I said in a recent post, you know, 50% of participants in any sporting event lose on any day. So, you know, it's not about who wins and who loses. It's about why are they winners and why are they losers. And the data that we analysed and the conclusions we came out with, the things that the people who were successful had in common were they generated more revenue per day per resident and they spent more money per day per resident.
That's interesting. So a lot of the organisations who are looking at cost-cutting measures and ways they can reduce the input per resident may actually be looking at it from a slightly, you know, skewed perspective.
I think it's the highest risk strategy, cutting out cost when all of the public is saying we want a higher level of service is only gives you a risk of more things going wrong. So the answer is, and I thought of this morning as I was contemplating this session, what would happen to someone if they actually advertised and said, we're now 10% dearer than this person down the road. However, we have 15% more staff. We have no restriction on incontinence products. And our average cost per meal per day is 50% ahead of what the industry average is. I think they'd get a lot of people coming to their door.
Absolutely. Were there any particular themes around how those organisations got the additional revenue per day or any particular areas of care that they did tend to spend more on?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you know, the lion's share of income is coming from ACFI. The people who got the best outcome had in-house ACFI capability. They may have supplemented it with external consultants, but they had the in-house capability. So they had the skill sets in their everyday working for them. Their ACFI was what they were entitled to for the care they were giving. So they were matching care with revenue. The second thing is that they tended to have a tight control of their staffing costs. It wasn't understaffed, but it was tightly controlled. Now, the percentages vary, but, you know, they were in the band of, you know, high 50% to high or mid 60% range is what you had, and it varies depending on structure. The other interesting thing was that groups that had between 2 and 5 facilities were the most profitable group in the survey.
So that sounds pretty interesting in terms of the, you know, making the most of the revenue side of things, having a staff member who knows the residents, knows them well, and can pick up on any clinical changes to get that ACFI in as quickly as possible to get the right level of funding. And on the cost side, was there anything that these providers seemed to do better than others in terms of care they were providing to differentiate themselves in the market?
Well, as I say, they had their wages portion of their care was within a tight band. And you might have what we see in people that aren't making money is that their wages percentage is well into the 70% of their revenue. The question that raises is they're providing care, they may be providing care, but not being paid for it. And if that's the case, then you can't make money. Or if you were getting paid for the care that you were providing, you might have inefficient work practices. And so that we don't know at a micro level which one it is unless we investigate it. And that's one of the core service lines we do is about resourcing. We go in and look at what the resourcing is relative to the ACFI and then work out what we think is the problem. Is it in the ACFI or is it in the resourcing? Because it can be in either.
Gotcha. So it may be a case of providing too many staff in some areas, may not be getting the right level of funding for the level of care they're providing, or it might be things like the type of engagement, so overuse of casuals or agency pools or so forth.
Yeah, let me give you an example. We've in some cases that we've done where we've worked with clients, we've actually been able to increase the hours of care staff by restructuring rosters for non-care staff. You know, in one case, we had a facility manager with a PA. Now, that all goes into the wages mix, and so you just don't know where the problem is until we got into the micro level and said, wait a minute, this is a very rare situation. It must go to work practices in the non-client-facing area. And so if you pull out the cost that's inefficient administrative cost, then that gives you more money to spend on care, and that improves quality, improves outcome. People will pay more.
Okay, yeah, that makes complete sense. Now, you mentioned about the organisations who tend to do better are of a particular size in terms of the number of facilities they have. Now, that's not something you can necessarily turn on a dime and influence overnight. What would be some of the things that an organisation could put on their to-do list to start doing to help them perform better? Are there any easy wins that some organisations could do or practices they could take away from this interview to start looking at, you know, making their bottom line a bit more healthy?
If there are any easy wins, I'm sure people would have them because there's no monopoly on knowledge. I think in the sector, there are definite issues around funding and we can't deny that. But at the end of the day, if you want to have a sustainable business, you've got to look at your revenue, because revenue is 100 and costs are some percentage of 100. So the best way to get more profit is to get more revenue. So what I would say people should be looking at is, firstly, ACFI, it's a fixed maximum amount and people should get their processes right around that. The next thing to say is, well, what other revenue streams have I got? And you've got the accommodation payment. And people assume that residents want to pay or will pay the RAD because it's cheaper. And we've done a lot of work around this, and there are options that you can go to around that that make it attractive for people not to pay a RAD. So that's the second revenue stream. The third revenue stream, which is the unregulated one, is additional services. And in my view is, and again, we're working on this now and getting lots of clients talking about it and engaging with us, the industry has to embrace additional services because it's the only unregulated revenue opportunity that exists.
And I guess that gets back to your earlier point about the organisation down the road who charges a bit more but has all these extra things. I guess we find that people are willing to dip into their pocket to get looked after better.
Yes, bearing in mind that additional services don't cover specified care and services, but we're moving into more of a lifestyle environment, and so people will happily pay for the things that they've assumed. And the work we've done is most providers are already giving between $600 and $2,000 per resident per annum in unrecouped additional services. If they simply started to change that going forward for new clients coming in, that has a material impact on their operating profit per bed. And then there are other things you can do on top of that.
Gotcha. So they seem to be actually already providing additional services, but not receiving the income for it.
That's right. And, you know, I use the analogy of the airline industry. Years ago, when you flew on Qantas, once you paid for your ticket, you got everything. Virgin came in, they disaggregated the fare, and all you got was the seat. You had to pay for the luggage, you had to pay for the drink, anything you wanted, you had to pay for. So I think that's the phase that we will start to go through, where people will disaggregate, and then what will happen after that, you get a re-aggregation. It's a normal economic cycle. But at the moment, people were given all these things because it was just the way we did it. As the funding gets tighter, people will have to make decisions that I can't afford to give people the free TV, can't afford to give them, you know, other forms of entertainment that are just, at the moment, are taken for granted. But what I can do is I can package up the services that people want and they will buy them. And that's been our experience with our clients.
Okay. And, you know, some people might think out there that, you know, that seems like a, you know, very business-orientated approach rather than a care-orientated approach. But I guess at the end of the day, if there are some residents who can get additional services and can afford to pay for them, that's better than the whole organisation going bankrupt and not being able to keep their doors open and care for anyone at all.
And I think it's better than being dependent on government, who has a history over time in any health sector of reducing the money that's available. You know, they did it for GPs with the Medicare, and so Medicare is now much a co-payment system. They've done it in pharmacy. They've done it in pathology services. You know, you've got waiting lists in the public hospital system. So the reality is the government has to get the services for the least amount of money because they've got lots of other priorities. So smart operators, and I haven't seen the detail of the Stuart Brown work, but I would imagine the 60% who are making money are the 60% who are proactive and taking control of their circumstances. And the 40%, most of the people in that sector would be those that are a bit more reactionary to what's happening. I don't know the detail, but that's my suspicion.
And now, if you could have any billboard at the next major aged care conference and you could have one message on it, what would it be?
The best market to be in is one that's growing. And the best way to be in a market is to be known for a niche service provision, which calls into question how people structure how they present themselves to the market. And I think that's the biggest issue that the industry faces, is that for too long, the regulation has caused each individual provider to try and be all things to all people. And that's very difficult. You can't provide a quality service on a budget price, and you can't do much about the price. So it's a matter of, we're in a great industry. It's a matter of how does the industry transition to meet the challenges going forward. And I would hope that the Royal Commission is very helpful in that process, both at increasing appropriate funding and, more importantly, minimising inappropriate regulation.
Absolutely. Now, if organisations are keen on you coming in and having a look under the bonnet and finding out where there are opportunities to run more efficiently and effectively, where can we find you?
You can find us at www.prideliving.com.au. You'll see in there, in fact, we've just launched our new website. It's simple and clear. It talks to those three main service areas that we work in, talks about the different service lines that we have in there. And we operate all over Australia. We've got an office in Sydney and an office in Melbourne, but virtual offices everywhere else. In fact, last week I was in Bendigo, Stawell, Melbourne, and this week I'll be in Adelaide, Perth and Sydney. So we're fairly mobile and we have clients all around Australia.
I can understand why you're familiar with the airline analogy then.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, look, I'll link to that website in the show notes, so if anyone wants to get in contact with you, they can easily. I just want to say thank you very much for your time, Bruce. I think there's a couple of actionable things in there as well that providers could immediately have a bit of a look at their organisation and seeing if they're doing the right things, particularly in terms of having the in-house ACFI support and their staffing models. So, yeah, just want to say thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Aged Care Executive Podcast. What drives us is knowing that we're providing content to help aged and community care professionals stay ahead of the industry. So please, if you get any value from what we're doing, the biggest reward we could ask is that you share this podcast with your colleagues. Don't forget to hit subscribe. It's free. And also leave us a review. 5 stars, hopefully, but if not, that's okay. But please, leave a comment and let us know what we can do better. or if there's any particular topics you'd like to hear about. If you'd like to connect with us or have any questions, you can find us on LinkedIn and Facebook at the Aged Care Executive Podcast.